Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 716, Interview with Russ Baker. This program is being recorded on June 6th of the year 2010. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Russ Baker, the author of the enormous and consummately important book, Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Russ Baker, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks a lot. We just keep going here.
Yes, once again, and we're getting into now what I guess one could call W Ascendant, and I hope that we have been able to at least familiarize the listeners with the networking that George W. Bush used to ascend to power, because it's some of the same networks that his father availed himself of, and which in turn are inextricably linked not only with big money, but with intelligence connections, and so many of W's connections, as is the case with George H.W. Pompey Bush, make no sense unless one examines them as intelligence and money laundering fronts. Speaking of money laundering fronts, we were doing just that in connection with Harkin Energy, one of W's many curious business ventures. How does Harkin Energy parlay into part ownership and a very profitable part ownership of the Texas Rangers on the part of W. Bush?
Well, I mean, because when his other first company failed and a second company took him in at an advantage to him, and then that company failed, and then Harkin took him in at another advantage to him, and then provided him with both compensation and stock, and he was able to sell the stock at a high just before it went down, where there were allegations of possible insider information. In any case, he was by this point already fairly well healed, and as I mentioned on our last program, George W. Bush would have had trouble becoming president even with the famed Bush name, based on the fact that he really just didn't have anything good on his resume. He had two small failed oil companies, and then he had been taken over by a third company, and that company was so murky and problematical that if it had been examined, it wouldn't have looked very good for him. He also was full of people involved with powerful foreign interests. So he needed something true blue American, something really down home, and what better than to be associated with professional baseball. And since he wasn't going to be a professional baseball player, the best opportunity was to be a businessman connected with a popular franchise, and that was the Texas Rangers baseball team. So in Family of Secrets, I have a chapter called Playing Hardball, and this is the story of how he got in and then what they did to make money off of the team. But what's significant here is that they approached a number of very wealthy individuals. This is a whole pattern here of influence peddling, approaching wealthy individuals who have a reason to want to get favors and be able to get their case before the vice president, the governor, what have you. And so they basically staked W. He put in, even though he made good money already and was already on his way to be wealthy from Harkin, he put in a fairly small amount compared to the other partners, and yet was given a disproportionate amount of stock. Now, the supposed reason for this was that he was being compensated for being managing partner, with the idea that they were just silent partners and he was actually managing the enterprise. And as I point in Family of Secrets, he wasn't managing the enterprise. He didn't know anything about it. Really, all he did, besides taking a stake in the company, was he showed up at the games and the camera focused in on him wearing his Rangers thing, and they would say, you know, George W. Bush, managing partner, Texas Rangers, and he was an instant hit. And of course, this is what made it possible for him to defeat Ann Richards, the incumbent, and become the governor of Texas.
Yep. Just ever so briefly, one of the interesting things about the steroid scandal that has engulfed baseball is a lot of the big names, Pudge Rodriguez, Alex Rodriguez, Rafael Palmeiro, Jose Canseco, Sammy Sosa, all tracked through the Rangers at this period in time.
What's interesting about that is that the theme, again, of getting an unfair advantage of a non-level, shall we say, playing field, and how one can game the system, which is a theme running through Family of Secrets, not only about Bushes themselves, but about the entire milieu of which they're part, and how this plays a role in America very much right up to the present moment. But in terms of the baseball team, what's interesting to me, as I discovered in researching Family of Secrets, was the extent to which the Bushes and their friends and this upper class group saw sports ownership as very, very important. it was not only for ego and that they enjoyed it, it was also that this made them, it was a kind of insurance, because people are very reluctant to investigate or look at or have doubts about the owners of successful sports ventures. Now, if the team is failing, that may be something else. But as long as the team is doing well and makes the public feel good, they're pretty secure. And so we find with the Bushes all the way back, the his great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker, who they named golf's Walker Cup after. He was involved with the introduction of golf itself into America. He was involved with the New York Yacht Club, professional tennis, very high up in premier horse racing. So they were working all this stuff. And then if you look at the commissioners, several of them in a row were friends of the Bushes, like Peter Uberoth, and one of the other ones actually lived in the Bushes' house before he became a commissioner. So they were very tightly woven into baseball, and they and their friends had stakes in tons of teams, the Reds, the Mets, the Tigers, and others.
You alluded to one of the owners, Mr. DeWitt of Spectrum 7. He was deeply involved with the Cincinnati Reds. And you also mentioned how that upper crust section of Cincinnati had a lot to do with carrying George W. Bush's electoral fortunes as well. Before we talk about W. Ascendant in politics, two more business ventures I'd like to touch on, one of which I'd never heard of, Lucky Chance Mining, an ironic name if ever there was one.
Yeah, that's one that I did. You know, a lot of these things that I came upon in researching Family of Secrets are not in any other books, or if they're in books, they're in briefly, but you see a kind of a lack of connecting dots. They're sort of treated as just sort of resume items, and they're described, but there isn't a lot more to it. But Lucky Chance isn't in anything, and I don't know, everybody missed it. It's not in articles, it's not in books, and this is a very interesting mining venture involving this same sort of murky group of people. One figure just tells me how they were bringing suitcases of cash back from the Caribbean. There was an odd sort of investment, East Coast investment banker who got in trouble with the SEC. He was well connected into blue blood circles in Kentucky, and he brought in people connected to the Shah of Iran. So again, you say, I mean, is this statistically significant or not, that in every one of these companies, it's people who seem to be moving money from the ancien regime of Iran, and then you had Saudis again, Saudis, Iran, the same circles continuously. And so Lucky Chance is a very strange thing involving mines out in California. And George W. Was brought in and was on the board of this entity. And it's very interesting that at one point when the outfit began getting a bit of scrutiny, he was off the board in a second. He was out of there. He did not even want to show up on the radar, and he didn't.
And he said he knows what happens when the press starts sniffing around, which suggests that there was something there that was beginning to smell. Another one of the Bush business ventures, you talked about the Texas Rangers and how marketable they were. And, of course, a major part of America's popular consciousness, I should say, is occupied by professional sports and also movies. Tell us about George W. Bush and Silver Screen Management, another one of these well-connected scenarios.
Yeah, this fellow who ran that company was from, again, a part of this old money apparatus. I don't recall the exact details, but it's all in Family of Secrets. His father, his grandfather, was worked for the Bushes and also handled the money for one of the great, not Astor, but one of the great.
Wasn't this Bass Richardson?
No, he now owns the Chelsea Piers, this very large sports complex in New York. And his mother worked for the OSS, and the father worked handling the money for, I want to say it was Astor.
Is this Betts we're talking about?
Betts, right. And yep. Astor is very interesting also because he was running intelligence. In World War II, you know, this was they were creating these new temporary intelligence entities and dividing up the pie, and Mr. Astor was in charge of a significant portion of intelligence for the Americas and for South America. Also a Rockefeller connection in there. So anyway, Mr. Betts, who'd gone to those same schools, again Yale and so forth, and was an old buddy of W, brought him into this company. The company, you know, conveniently got financing again back through the Bushes, or their relatives, and they basically were investors in films, and they invested in a lot of films that were released by Disney, and the ones that were promoted in the The articles when Bush ran for office were ones where I want to say sort of, Sleeping Beauty, Beauty and the Beast, whatever. But they also had, this horrific slasher movie, which was never mentioned for some reason. But anyway, that was another thing that was, looked sort of odd financially. And again, he seems to have done quite well with it.
Yep, and the Disney empire is deeply involved, heavily overlapped with Silver Screen Management, as you point out. Let's encapsulate ever so brief, because I'd like to get to W, the president. But in a way, I think some of the cynicism and class orientation of the Bush presidency's presidential terms was anticipated or foreshadowed in W's governorship. Encapsulate his governorship for us, if you would, Russ Baker.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing... There's a lot you could say, but the key thing is that the governor of Texas doesn't do very much. It's a largely ceremonial position, and the way it's structured, the lieutenant governor has the actual statutory power in the state, and also does most of the work. And so as governor, he was able to articulate a few issues. He certainly has a appointment power and some other powers. And so he articulated a few issues that were all, of course, very carefully focused, group tested. They were already trying to see if they could use the education issue, tough on crime. They used the so-called tort reform. This was the different issues appealed to different constituencies, capital punishment. So some of them were very much for the average voter, but then some of them, like that so-called tort reform thing, was very much a play for the wealthy donors, where they were basically assuring them that they were going to get the threat of class actions off their backs. And we see these giant donors to Bush, and then years later to things like the so-called grassroots swift boat veterans movement that attacked and badly wounded John Kerry in the 2004 election. And some of those people were people who were facing significant lawsuits in Texas, whose burden was made much less by the activities of Bush as governor. So, he was able to create an image of himself as somebody who was tough and very, very effective. There was a lot of a double standard stuff there. He was very tough on things like a crime, and there are some issues about some things in his past and whether he was held accountable for them. He was very tough on the issues like social issues, family issues, abortion, and so forth. And as you know, in Family of Secrets, I do tell the story of the alleged case in which a girlfriend of his is purported to have had an abortion after being pressured by the Bush circle to do so. And I go into that fairly extensively in Family of Secrets.
One of the things when George Bush was in the late 90s and obviously getting ready to run for president, and a puff piece biography was written about him initially by a long time, but one of these many people who sort of networks transgenerationally with the Bush family. This guy was tight with Poppy Bush, then later W. Bush, a journalist named Mickey Herskowitz. And you relate some very interesting things that he had to say about what was on George W. Bush's mind in the late 1990s.
Mickey had known the father quite well. They'd both been in Houston. Mickey was a sports writer for the Houston Chronicle, who also he had a column, and he also had an interest in other subjects. And so he had penned all of these sort of ghost-written books for lots of different figures, ranging from Mickey Mantle to Reagan's advisor Michael Deaver, John Connolly to Dan Rather, a tremendous range of figures. And he was seen as a very much of a nonpartisan figure. And so he knew the Bush family and had approached W when he was running for president and about the possibility of them doing a book together. And W said, well, you better check with Carl, and Carl Rove was just too busy and this was not on his radar. And he said, well, if he wants to do it, it's okay with me. So they were ready to sign a deal. Bush, his main concern about the book, really, the only thing he actually seemed to ask Mickey was how much money was in it for him. And there's an interesting question for somebody who is now running for president of the United States to be asking how much money you can make off of something. But he did. And Mickey explained, I believe, that they were going to split the proceeds and Mickey would do all the work. He just needed to have some quality time with W and ask him some questions. And so as they began having what ended up being, I believe, approximately 20 different conversations, either in person or on the phone, Mickey explained to him that they were going to go over W's life, and they began doing that, and W became uncomfortable, and he said, you know, I really don't want to do this. And he said, you know, there really isn't much to talk about. And he said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I really haven't done a lot. I'm not that comfortable with this. And, of course, had that come out, that he was the odds-on favorite to be president of the United States in a short time, and he felt he had not done enough to warrant brief mention in a book. But Mickey did stay with him on that. And one of the things he remembers asking him, you know, he took him through the years, and then he said, okay, and he joined the Guard and how much he loved to fly. And then he said, and what did you do next? And then he said, and then I went to Alabama to work on a senatorial campaign. And he said, okay, that was 1972, and what did you do about your ongoing Guard service? And according to Mickey, Bush replied, nothing, I was excused. Now, this is a huge revelation because the Bush reelection campaign was all about trying to convince the press, and was very successful ultimately at this, that Bush himself had completed his military service, had continued to serve in Alabama, even though the records and the recollections indicate otherwise. And here he was confessing to Herskowitz that he simply didn't participate in the military anymore. So this was a problem for them that he had said this. But then they continued talking, and then he said, look, I'd rather talk about, what else can we talk about? So Mickey said, well, you know, the other thing to put in a book like this is what you're going to do as president. And so waiting, you know, to hear some spontaneous things, because you don't want these books to read too canned, Bush said, you talk to Carl. Carl will tell you what I'm going to do as president. This in itself is an interesting revelation. But he kept pressing Bush, and they talked about a bunch of things. And suddenly, according to Mickey, Bush brightened. And he said, well, I'll tell you one thing I'm going to do. And he said, I'm not going to be like my dad. You know, he says, what he did with Iraq, he said, if I've got a chance, heck, I'm going to go in there, but I'm going to go all the way in, take that dude out. He said, I'm going to take Saddam Hussein out. He said, I'm going to finish the job. And Herskowitz was sort of surprised by this, and he said, what's your thinking on that? And the reason he gave was the most astonishing thing. I'll tell it briefly here, but really the fuller rendition is contained in Family of Secrets, and it's somewhat complex. But in a nutshell, Bush told Herskowitz that he felt that he had been convinced over the years as a political advisor to his father and watching the presidencies and also foreign leaders like Margaret Thatcher, who was very unpopular in England until something happened. There was the invasion of the Falkland Islands, the little tiny islands that had more sheep than people. It was a completely mismatched battle against the Argentines, and Britain won easily, but she became a hero. And the Reagan-Bush administration had watched this with tremendous admiration, and W. remembered this, and he remembered people telling him that if you wanted to be a leader with high poll ratings, you had to have a war.
And, of course, for him, already foreshadowing before he was president that he was going to invade Iraq. We've got about 40 minutes left in this interview, Russ Baker, a lot to talk about. How would you characterize the 2000 election and election campaign itself and W's formal ascension to the presidency?
Well, I mean, first of all, he was very lucky to have Al Gore running against him, just because one thing you can say about W, as much as he's got those problems with expressing himself, he really is a very magnetic figure, and much more so than his father. And Karl Rove spotted this early on, that he could be quite charming, quite gregarious, that he could think on his feet, and that if he had a limited number of things to pull out of a sort of a kit bag, he could, because he was a jokester, he was a storyteller, and so he would know how to do that. He just needed a few arrows in his quiver. And of course, they worked very, very hard to lower the expectations, and the media sort of ridiculously set one standard for him and another standard for Gore. And so if Gore, you know, would exaggerate a small thing, they'd be all over for him about that, instead of focusing on his, you know, his intelligence, his competency in general, what he had achieved over the years as a senator. With Bush, they really just said, you know, all he's got to do in this debate is not fall over, and he's going to come out of this pretty well. And so that's what they did. It was a well-managed effort, and they also worked very hard, as we know, to marginalize blocks of voters, particularly in Florida. and you know the kind of strategies that Karl Rove had developed over the years. And then, of course, I don't want to just rush through this, but then, of course, we had with the recount in Florida that the Bush side began to run at something like an intelligence operation. They called in all kinds of operatives who rushed there, exert pressure. I mean, it wasn't just the lawyers. They were exerting pressure all over the place on this thing. They were working every angle of it. And, of course, ultimately, we saw how politicized court appointments should have become and how the judiciary is not immune to pressure. So that was it, and there we were, and we at least Mickey Herskowitz already knew that we were headed possibly for war with Iraq long before 2003, indeed, long before the September 11 attacks.
I want to recall briefly for veteran listeners, too, that a lot of the Republican cadre on the ground, their boots on the ground, in the sort of mini riots that were occurring around the Florida recount, were people who once again tracked back to the whole Bay of Pigs thing and the media, not only involving Bay of Pigs, but later the Kennedy assassination, right on up to Watergate. And as you point out, Russ Baker, the Iran-Contra affair as well. George Bush does get appointed president of the United States, and immediately, well, you know what we should perhaps mention in connection with this briefly is his discovery of Jesus, how he came to Jesus, and how that fits into the political marketability of Bush.
Right. That was another thing. I mean, it seemed in the end, almost everything I looked at about him, almost everything that we read about in these best-selling books about him, almost everything we heard on the TV shows and we read on the front pages of the newspapers was carefully constructed and largely untrue. And yet today, most people believe these things are true. And so, you know, the reason for Iraq turned out to be other than has been said. What I am telling all of you here now about the Herskowitz thing is a story I broke. If you've heard of it, it's because it's on the internet. But that was not known and is not known to the vast majority of Americans. The same thing with the religious conversion. The story is that he had been drinking too heavily and was being a bad father and the business was bad and that he turned for solace to the Lord. The problem with that story is that, I wasn't ordinarily inclined to question that because you really don't want to start speculating about what goes on with people in terms of their spirituality or their psychology on that level. But I did actually assemble enough information to suggest, at least in terms of timing, that this was, like all these other things, a cynical calculation. You have to remember that they faced a couple of problems. Number one, he had skipped out on the military. That was something he would never recover from if any dogged journalist was able to really get to the bottom of it and make that story stick. And he also faced the problem that he really just hadn't done anything in his life of note up until he'd become, you know, governor of Texas. And so how do you deal with the fact that there's one thing you don't want anybody to look at, or if they do, you want to be able to excuse it, and in the general, just divert attention from the fact that you really didn't accomplish much, and now you want to be the most powerful person in the world. And so the solution, and I have to assume that Karl Rove had a hand in this, they realized that basically he needed a clean slate. He needed to simply wipe the memory bank on everything. And so how do you do that? Well, either you have to wipe everybody's memories or you have to just wipe your own slate. And the one really good way to wipe your own slate is a mea culpa, a kind of an apology. And the best and biggest apology you can ever have is to become born again. Because by definition, you're casting all your sins away. You are starting over again. And so he declared that he was starting over again, and basically everyone else would have to start over again when it came to even considering him. And if you look at the press coverage of him in 2000, that's just what they did. They really sort of let all that other stuff go. Now, what I found in researching Family of Secrets was that you can actually figure out the timing of this, and that the year before the year in which he himself says he first saw the light in the 1980s, the year prior to that, his father was receiving advice from a Republican operative, Pentecostal minister / consultant who was advising them the Bush family, particularly the father, that he needed to get religion, that it wasn't good enough to be this sort of uptight Episcopalian who, you know, went to church once a week or something, that this was not going to play with the masses, that America had gone a much more fundamentalist route. Ronald Reagan knew that. Jimmy Carter knew that. They both played off of that very successfully. And that was becoming this enormous, almost unitary block in American elections, and that it was essential. And so Poppy was struggling with that. And in Family Secrets, I actually tell the story of the interplay between Poppy and this man, Doug Weed, and how Doug is writing memos to him, but the Poppy is so secretive that he's got cutouts, got surrogates, and he's sort of, there's even a point where Doug Weed is asked to come in and talk to one of Poppy's aides, and he's talking to him, and the door is slightly ajar, and he has a feeling there's somebody sitting by the door listening, and he later concluded that was probably Poppy Bush, again, listening what he needed to do. And then later on, he and Poppy actually went to the Religious Broadcasters Convention together, and he was trying to advise Poppy on how to change his speech, because he said, no, this is all wrong. Poppy had trouble, you know, he was a kind of stiff character. He had trouble adapting. But the son, who was a top advisor to the father, apparently was reading all of these memos and was going, yes, this guy is right. This guy is right. This is what my father has to do, and this is what I'm going to do. Because the son already knew he was going to be in the limelight, either as the eldest son and namesake of the future president of the United States, or as a candidate in his own right. And so it certainly, the timing looks like it was a very easy decision for him to make. Because, you know, if any of us decide we want to become born again, it really, you just say you are, and that's it. You don't have to do a lot. He went to some very mild Bible study classes with some of his pals in Midland, where he was prone to making jokes during them. And but there he was. And then he also announced that he had stopped drinking. And that's another very interesting thing, because by saying that he had stopped drinking, what he did was he actually drew attention to the fact that he had been a drinker before. And I think you can argue that by being born again, he appealed to one group. And by talking about the fact that he used to like drinking, he appealed to another group, which was sort of the good old boys who still like to drink. Because they look at him, because, you know, ultimately they say that these elections come down to who would I rather have a cup of coffee with or a drink with. And, well, I'd rather have a drink with a guy who used to drink a beer and go fishing than some stuffed shirt like Al Gore.
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, by becoming born again, George W. Bush placed himself in harmony with one of the largest Republican electoral elements, namely the born-agains, the Christian fundamentalists. So
that's right. And
it didn't hurt a bit.
It's absolutely certain that the 2000 election and the 2004 election would not even have been close if it had not been for enormous numbers of self-described evangelical fundamentalists and Pentecostalist Christians to back him.
Yep. And we're going to be talking about what actually unfolded as George W. Bush, the born-again Christian, becomes president of the United States. Russ Baker, tell us once again about how to get Family of Secrets on your website.
Okay, bookstores, local support, local independent community bookstores. Hopefully they have the book. If they don't, they can order it. The chains, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and what have you. Online, barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com, our website, familyofsecrets.com. You can order it through that. And then we've got, very importantly, our new journalism website, Who, What, Why, the three words, whowhatwhy.com. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, independent investigative journalism website looking at the questions of the day and on into the future with the same investigative rigor, supported with public donations. We hope people will back us.
All righty. We've been visiting with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, and this concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 715, being recorded on June 6th of the year 2010. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.